So before we go any further, because of the wealth of knowledge and experience that you have from your time here, is there anything that, as you reflect on that time, that you would like to share with us that I or Don may not bring out with our questions? So please take your time and think. There may be a few things that you would like to share with us before we go any further. And we will return to this question at the end as well.
You know, when I first came here, the first judgment, which was the Akayesu judgment, in which I had no role, was disparaged a bit. I remember there were a number of whispers down the corridor about it was too long, it wasn't didn't address issues as directly as it could have. But it has, in so many ways, withstood the test of time. And sometimes I refer, when I'm coordinating a judgment or when I'm advising a judge, I will go back and refer to the Akayesu judgment in its articulation of genocide, because it was the first case in any international tribunal that held, that made a holding on genocide. And it was the first case that charged rape as an act, as an act of genocide, and the first conviction for rape as a tool of genocide and as a crime against humanity. So it was, and also the definition of rape was just so incredible as you think about it. And I, oh my goodness, I fought so hard as we were moving away from that definition in the Muhimana judgment to conciliate what was then perceived as a divergence, and to work with the judges to show that it really wasn't a divergence, that in fact we still were adhering to the Akayesu conceptual definition of rape, and that the elements of rape, which were mechanical, that is, they were in specific in terms of the penetration of what of what part of the body by what part of the body. I can get very, very specific about this. It's really quite graphic. This mechanical definition had been articulated by the appeals chamber of the ICTY in Firenze, and in, my goodness, it'll come back to me in just a second. But I'll come back to that. And there was the argument that there was a rejection of Akayesu. And I was reading what a number of scholars were saying, particularly somebody whom I admire greatly, by the an American by the name of Kelly Askin. And she had made the argument that no, the Akayesu definition, which is a conceptual one, which is, if I can read it to you, a physical invasion of a sexual nature committed on a person under circumstances which are coercive. General, there is no element of consent was rejected because this was a situation of genocide. How could you even envision consent in a situation like this of such violence? However, in the ICTY appeals chamber, in the appeals, there was again consent right in there, and went back to, you have to have the invasion of any part of the body, whether it be the mouth, whether it be the anus, by the penis, or by an object. I mean, here you were using all of this, these graphic, mechanical, specific elements. And so how do you reconcile going with these specific elements and this conceptual definition? I think, and I do hope this is adhered to by future judgments, that that conciliation was achieved in Muhimana. And this was a judgment issued in 2005. We have had a paucity of judgments that have addressed rape. Out of the 29 cases, only to date, and I'm talking about to date, as of today's date, we're not talking about any of the judgments that may be issued in the coming months before January 2009. We have had only 8 cases charging rape. Only 8. And of those, only 4 have been upheld on appeal. Now, you probably need to talk to the prosecutor as to why there were no more cases charging rape. There are certainly reasons for this. It's more difficult, perhaps, to prove rape because you need to have the victims or the witnesses be survivors. How many of those who were raped survived? And how many of those who survived, given the cultural taboo in the Rwandan society, are willing to testify? What do they get from testifying? In fact, it's a wonderful, horrific story of a witness in Akayesu who, after testifying, of course, like many, when I say of course, it's not obvious, but like many, she's still alive, a victim of AIDS. And also somebody living in great poverty. And there was a program here, also through the trust fund, that provided housing to many of the victims who survived of the Rwandan genocide. And this one witness in Akayesu, I think it's witness JJ, almost positive, was living as far as here to that pillar from this new development of homes built by trust fund monies for survivors. She, 3 years after her testimony, was living still with no wall in her little dwelling. Of course no electricity, of course no running water. And she pointed to that building and she said, "You know, that was built for the survivors. But there's one person who owns 3 of those little houses and rents them. So in fact, those people who most need them are not necessarily receiving them." Now, there was a bit of publicity about this, and a church group subsequently helped her to restore that wall that had been open. She had courage to testify. There are many survivors because of all of the issues involved with making known your story, do not testify. Are you going to have a husband if you're young enough still to have a husband. You're a tarnished woman. Oftentimes, at least, you're thought of being a tarnished woman. And consequently, it is difficult to find the witnesses testifying to sexual violence.